You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And this is the Watchathon of Rassilon.
That is true.
Today we're going to be talking about the fifth serial of the 14th season of Doctor Who, The Robots of Death!
Robots!
Which consists of four episodes that aired from January 29th, 1977 to February 19th, 1977.
True facts!
And I want to give a special shout out to Bisexual Brigadier for purchasing this DVD for us.
Thanks, Bisexual Brigadier!
This is very nice of you.
Yeah.
But you can follow her on Tumblr at bisexualbrigadier.tumblr.com. And today we have two returning guests.
Ooh.
Yeah. Double the fun. I'm going to go in alphabetical order by last name, which is it's also first name. we have our Ice Warrior expert, Ashley Rayburn.
Yay.
I'm glad to be back.
Hi.
Yeah, hey.
And we also have Hulanta person.
That's it. That's official title.
And book guy.
Hulanta guy.
Hulanta book guy. R. Allen Seiler.
Howdy. How's it going?
Going pretty good. How's it going with you guys?
Great.
Talk at the same time. Go.
Yeah, we will.
Oh, but we try to avoid crosstalk. Sorry. Yeah, doing well. Doing well. How are you guys?
Doing pretty good.
Sweet.
Yeah.
It's a good time for Doctor Who right now.
It is. Absolutely.
Is it?
I think so.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Might depend on who you ask.
That is very true.
So, since the last podcast that we recorded, there has been not one, not three, but two new episodes of the TV show. Our first couple episodes with 13. Well, full episodes with 13.
Yes. She is great.
Yeah, she is.
Yep.
So, we're all agreed there.
Yeah, basically.
So what are your guys' like overall opinion of the show so far, the new show?
Yeah, so my thing is that I actually haven't seen the second episode yet.
Oh.
Yeah, I know, I'm horrible. I think this is literally the first time I've waited this long to see an episode, and it has nothing to do with anything beyond the fact that I'm just I was out of town this weekend, so I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. But I absolutely loved the first one. I thought it was fantastic, and it felt very classic to me in a way. I mean, there was something about specifically there's something from Classic Who about the monsters in Classic Who, and there's this idea of like honor and these kinds of things in the races that you see, and you got this villain that came from this race that had their own kind of honor, this honor system that was much different than ours perhaps, but it felt very classic in that respect. Now the way it kind of went around things was a little different, but I and my co-host on the Oncoming Storm knows this about me. When we did it, is I love great Doctor Who adventure stories, space opera adventure stories, and some people just want, you know, they want not just, but they want character development and all this, and I want companions running down corridors screaming.
I'm with you on that.
So I do like where it's going in that respect, in terms of what I've seen so far.
I think the danger is, in my opinion, the Russell T. Davies era got a bit soap opera-y, and I think that we have the danger of that happening again, especially with this dynamic between Ryan and Graham. The angsty, you're not my real dad, but I married your mom, so I kind of am, kind of thing. In this case, it's grandparents. It's not, you know, but that whole thing is such an overused trope as an excuse for character development or character launch pad, maybe. So I'm really hoping that they're not going to tread too far down that path, you know, that it's not going to be like they're not going to belabor that whole point.
But at least they have an outsider with them. which typically the in the Russell T. Davies era, they never really did. They turned it into a triangle. And even in the early days of Moffitt, they did that. And at least there's that outsider, and the outsider not being the doctor, being another companion.
Yes, but that's only until they introduce the romance angle between Ryan and Yaz.
Well, fair enough.
And that will happen. I'm saying episode 4, that's going to happen. Laying predictions.
I wouldn't care for it.
I kind of agree with you. I'm not a very big fan of fridging Grace.
Okay. Is it fridging if she comes back later in the season? Does it count as fridging?
I mean, I think it still kind of counts as fridging. Spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen it. I'm about to talk about a certain comic book movie that happened recently.
Does it start with a D?
Yes. Deadpool 2 also did the fridging and then unfridging, which I feel like that's even worse because it didn't even acknowledge it as a trope, and Deadpool acknowledging tropes is like a thing.
That actually like surprised me in Deadpool, whereas like I'm not going to get one joke about it, and it turns out that the people who made it were like, I'd never heard of that before.
Well, and that was done in Torchwood also, in like that season 1 of Torchwood.
Yeah, Susie. But her death, it didn't happen to advance the storyline of one of the male characters. She just died.
Well, I mean, in a way, they used it as a jumping on point where they got to come back with Owen's character, and they're like, well, they're all the same, you know.
What's really nice about that one, though, is that by the way they promoted the series before it aired, you would have no reason to believe that she wasn't a main character for the entire season, because she was in all the character profiles, she was in all the cast group shots, everything. With this one, it was the Doctor and the three companions. Nan was never...
Yeah, she came out of nowhere.
They said she's, you know, the actress that's going to be in this season. She plays, you know, a character, and that's about it. But she wasn't part of the... She wasn't presented as part of... So you knew she was going to... You didn't necessarily know that she's going to die, but, you know.
And I feel like it's a missed opportunity, because I feel like that dynamic of, like, an older couple on the TARDIS would be so amazing.
I would love to have an old married couple on the TARDIS. That seems like it'd be so much fun.
I agree. The real opportunity that they're taking here, though, is that, you know, if you watch back on, especially the Rose period, like, when they introduce Adam, and he doesn't work out, he says, but I still want to travel with you. The Doctor says, I only take the best. That's why I have Rose. And there are these people that have been companions who are always the ideal companion material. The one that was truly companion material was Grace. So getting rid of her, you have the opportunity to have these people who aren't the natural companion prototype. They have to jump in and learn how to be companions. And I think that's going to be fun in itself.
Also, there is a that role's already filled. There's already a Grace who is in the medical field that was pretty much a companion. So
that's what I was going to say. You can't have two Graces.
That would get really confusing.
I feel like part of the reason they wanted to get rid of her was to have the whole Graham-Ryan dynamic. But I feel like you could still have that by, at the end of the episode, they all go into space, but Grace has been left behind. And you could still have that, like, Ryan and Graham are forced to be together thing without Grace, without her having to be dead.
Can I just say, I'm waiting for the moment that he calls him Graham Dad.
Graham Dad?
Yes.
Or when the Doctor calls him that.
If it doesn't come up, I'm going to be, like, really disappointed.
One thing that I really want to see, and I certainly do not want them to harp on the gender issue, but in this second episode, here's a spoiler for Ashley. In the second episode, she's speaking to something, and she says, come to Daddy. And then she goes, nope, come to Mommy. They used to do that kind of thing with Dax on DS9, where she would have different gender ideas in her head because she had been, or the symbiont had been, in male and in female hosts before. You know, how everybody would address her as old man because her previous host was a male. That I kind of like, and I wouldn't mind having the Doctor, you know, switch her pronoun once in a while just as a mistake or out of habit or something.
I'm waiting for the time she has to, like, come up with a fake name and she's like, John Smith. Oh, no.
Right. Right, I hadn't thought about that. So another aspect of the show that I am super, super excited about is the new composer, Sagan Akinola. I have loved everything that I've heard so far.
So one of the things about, in terms of the music, is that we've had Murray Gold for this whole period, which is very good. I mean, Murray Gold's very good, but he had a very specific style, and I do think that he was getting a little stale. Not because his music was bad, but because at some point you do need to move on when you're doing the same thing day in, day out. I was really surprised. I really had this idea that Chris Chibnall was going to just, and maybe I was completely wrong in this, obviously I was, but he was going to really just take away everything Doctor Who from Doctor Who. And I was incredibly pleasantly surprised by the theme song. It's literally, it sounds like, I don't know, I haven't looked to see how it's made, but it almost sounds like samples of the original theme song with drums on it, right? It's got the same sounds, it's got the swishes, it's got all this. I think the first theme song, the Murray Gold song, had that underlying, but there was all this swelling music on top of it. But really, it's the original theme song with like some drums and maybe a few extra synthesizers put in.
It is, yeah. It's a very modernized version of the original.
Is it actually the same recording sampled in there?
From what I understand, yeah.
I thought it was too, but I hadn't actually read it.
It's such a small, dumb thing for me to like, for how happy it makes me, but the fact that the title sequence is mirrored makes me insanely happy. It's just it's like a very small kind of old school reference that I'm like, nice. And like, in addition, it's like just freaking beautiful.
Yeah, it really is.
It makes you flash back to Dr. Oho.
Yes! That's exactly what I thought the first time of the very first episode.
I also love the fact that they put the middle eight in it. And, I mean, that's my favorite part of the Doctor Who theme song. My favorite version of that is actually the Seventh Doctor theme song, where they do this incredible version of the middle eight, and it was great to hear that being put back in at the beginning. I mean, it's part of the song. It's not just like, it might be in the end of the show because it needs to be a little longer. Like, it really did that. It was fantastic. I love that middle eight.
We should probably start talking about Classic Who right about now.
I do.
As much as, like, I don't think any of us have really had a chance yet to talk about the new stuff.
I do want to say I think it's gorgeous.
Yes.
The casting is great. I am looking forward to having an episode not written by Chris Chibnall, though. I want to see other people bring some stuff.
This next week is a new writer, which I'm very excited about.
Same. There are still some little Chris Chibnall issues I'm having, but not as bad as I was expecting.
I feel like all of the right choices are being made, but the problems I have with Chibnall's writing is still there.
Yeah.
But like every change that's been made, I'm like, ooh, yes, yes, good. It looks great. Like, all of the pieces that are going into it are perfect.
Capaldi's first season was sort of uneven. It was hit and miss. The second season, though, was just a rocket ride. It was amazing. And I really, it just takes some time, especially when you have changed the entire production crew, basically. Cast and crew, it'll just take some time for them to work out how they want to do Doctor Who. And I think by the second season, it's going to be gangbusters.
Let's hope so. That'd be awesome.
And it does feel so classic. It feels way more classic than I thought it was going to feel. Let me say that.
I totally agree with that.
I really appreciate that. And I don't know yet if it feels classic the same way that like Russell T. Davies era felt classic. Early Russell T. Davies, like when we're first seeing it and experiencing it. Or if it feels classic because it actually is. I'm not sure.
I will say, you haven't seen the second episode yet, but the second episode feels very classic. It reminded me a lot of Keys of Marinus. So.
Yeah.
Well, Ashley, go watch it now, and then we can talk about it before Robots of Death.
We'll wait.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just sit around.
Well, I guess you guys will be up to that in, what, like 5 years, 6 years, something like that? So just bring me back.
Make sure you've watched it by then, and you'll be good.
I will.
But yeah, let's
Robots of Death. Let's do it.
Let's talk about some Classic Who. Robots of Death. Let's talk about episode one, which I have two titles for. The Sandstorm of Death.
Sure.
Or Chub Rubbed Out.
Oh
dude.
Why?
Because Chub gets rubbed out.
Let's just start with the fact that somebody has a cruel sense of humor to name him Chub. I mean, how do you take him seriously anyway?
It was a thing, right? I mean, George Lucas had Porkins.
George Lucas has a whole series of problems. Let me tell you. Elon Sleazebagano? He created a character named Elon Sleazebagano, but written by Chris, I don't know how you pronounce it, Boucher? The Booch.
You're the one with the Joe Facts.
Who wrote the last serial, which was very good, Face of Evil.
Is he still alive?
Chris Boucher is apparently still alive.
Oh, okay. Well, we should get him for Hulanta.
Done.
He wrote two solid serials in a row. That's pretty impressive. He basically full-on introduced Leela.
Yeah, definitely. They weren't sure if they were going to keep her on as a companion, so by the time they decided that, it was kind of late in the process, and they asked Chris, will you please write her second story, because there's no time to create and distribute a character bio for other writers, so just write the second one also. And he's like, okay, yeah.
Joseph, I'm looking at your notes, and they start with a very local reference.
They do.
It just says Ruby Falls. And if you're not from this area, that doesn't mean anything.
Yep. Ruby Falls and Rock City have a very certain aesthetic that is this planet.
I mean, it's caves with gel lights over it.
You're right. You say that, and I'm like, holy crap, you're right. You say Ruby Falls, and I think about this, and I'm like, you're right.
They probably filmed it there.
Except for the sandstorm that was just constantly going. I don't remember that at Ruby Falls.
It's been a while since I've been there, so I don't know.
I was there recently. There was no sandstorm. Fact check confirmation.
I really want to know what the rest of this planet looks like. Is it just like a sand planet? Is it like tropical everywhere except for in this one part of the world? I want to know how many other companies run sand miners and stick them out in this place. And, you know, I don't know. Is it like the Deadliest Catch?
Ooh. Oh man, can you imagine a reality show on one of these?
Especially when there's all these murders going on. That's good television right there.
Sand miners. Do we know the name of this planet? I don't know if it's ever mentioned.
No, they never name it.
The neat thing about this story is there's like little references to other things. This is actually, if I'm not mistaken, and Alan, correct me if I'm wrong, but this story actually connects. This is the connecting point to Blake 7.
Kind of, because Chris Boucher went, I think, from here to be the script editor on Blake 7.
But Keldor City is mentioned in this, right?
Yes, it is.
And Keldor City is in Blake 7.
Isn't there also a Rassilon uniform in Blake 7? Like, that has the seal on it? I think from the...
It was when it was from the Revenge of the Cybermen?
Yes.
But there was in the audio series, Keldor City, they got Chris Boucher to write a couple of episodes of that. The guy who plays Yuvanov and the guy who plays Pool came back and recreated their parts. And Chris Boucher wrote in a Blake 7 character that he had written in Blake 7. He wrote it into Keldor City. So now there is this big connection between the two. Oh, but he also, yeah, I tell you, in Keldor City, he also wrote in the Findal, because he wrote that one, too. So the Findal are even in Blake 7 by roundabout means.
Why are you scrunching up your face? Do you not like
that?
Well,
here's the thing. I eventually want to consume all Doctor Who media possible. Does that mean I'm eventually going to have to watch all of Blake 7?
I mean, it's great.
You would want to anyway.
It's fantastic.
In fact, I have not watched it. I've watched the first episode, and I intend to do a watch through the whole thing. So, hey, let's do a podcast together.
Let's do
Woo!
It.
Watch-a-thon spin-off.
Right on.
Is there anything in Blake 7 that rhymes with a-thon?
Avon.
Avon. There you go. Perfect.
One of the main characters.
All right, there you go.
Avon-a-thon. Oh, yeah. You can have the Avon-a-thon. Let's do it.
I love it.
Blake 7 is super fun. It was created by Terry Nation, and they almost had the Daleks in it, and it was taken out at the very end, very last second.
I gotta say, saying that it's written by Terry Nation isn't like a huge selling point for me.
Hey, come on, man. That man had imagination. He didn't know the difference between solar system and galaxy, but he had an imagination.
Told the same story 5 times.
But in different ways.
With different characters.
He just knew when he had something good.
So those robots of death.
Yeah.
Robots of death.
Shoot, you guys.
So this serial is an amalgamation of like 3 different pop culture references. Dune, which is where the sand mining comes from. Isaac Asimov.
I've never read or otherwise consumed any kind of Dune media.
Oh, you are missing out.
I've seen the movie and the miniseries. I haven't read the book.
The book is phenomenal.
Well, there's about to be a new role-playing game, too, so there you go.
Ooh.
So you can just dive right into that world.
Right in. You can just experience it. Sandworms and all.
So you got that aspect influencing the sand mining part of this serial. You've got Isaac Asimov and his like rules of robotics, which is influencing the robot aspect of the story. And then you also have Agatha Christie, which is influencing the murder mystery aspect of this serial. So they're just ripping off everybody.
Hey, man, that's what they did at this period of the show.
That's what good storytelling is. Like, I'm going to have a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I'll, like, mash it all up into something that's different and fun.
It's, I mean, it's not like they don't do that in New Who, too. It's, like, I don't know how many times there's been, like, an Alien or Aliens ripoff.
Yeah, I can't think of any time they've referenced Agatha Christie.
No, not at all.
They ripped Aliens off so bad that the sets from the movie are actually in a serial. You're not there yet, so I won't ruin it for you.
So, but there's this great big mining. What do you?
It's vehicle? A model.
It's supposed to be huge.
It's like a huge ship. And I watched some of the documentary, and basically they were talking about like people who do go off on like fishing expeditions and stuff like that, or whatever, or maybe I don't remember. But like, yeah, they would have like nice accommodations because they're going to be out there for a while. So that's why like they're all the people inside of it are like.
They are,
hella
like,
fancy.
Lounging, and they are way fancy. Oh, my gosh, there are some great outfits.
The outfits.
Okay, nobody dresses like they're on a sand miner. You know, like, they're on a mining ship, but they're all, like, dressed for a cocktail party.
Yeah, but, like, all the robots are doing all the hard work. They're just laying around playing, like, space chess and eating grapes.
Well, it's like it's a bunch of rich people. Like, when do rich people actually get their hands dirty? That's the thing. That it was almost like it's like almost like a cruise, but one of those like cruise to like see how the other half lives. They're like, oh, I'm gonna pay and go work on a sand miner. That sounds fun.
Oh, that's interesting. Because here's the thing: you've got this clear like class structure in whatever society this is. Yuvanov, who is the captain of this ship, is obviously not from one of the upper, you know, the ruling houses, where these other people are, because they reference it a number of times. Zilda in particular is, you know, from, is Zilda and her fancy family. So why are they working for him? How did they get involved in this sand mining business?
He has said multiple times, he's like, I'll make your family rich again.
For Zilda, yeah, but is that for all of them?
I don't know what's up with any.
Maybe they're all just some greedy mofos. That's just gonna
get some money.
More money.
The captain, he's kind of just, you know, it's almost like he's like, look, I just have to do this one last one and I can stop doing this. But these people, it's like they're just there for fun. I mean, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. They're just having like cocktail parties and the robots are literally doing all of the work.
Well, that's why you have robots.
I guess so.
That's probably why they're working for him. It's just cheap, easy money that's mostly automated.
I mean, they're obviously, you know, like scrubbing the deck and picking up any like trash that's on the floor, because this is the most pristine mining ship you'll ever see.
I wonder if there is, in terms of writing this, if there is any thoughts going into this that where they were kind of making allusions to the Antebellum South, in a way. There's something similar there. I mean, we talked about the other things, but there's some cultural mashups there, too, where you've got the rich white people and then the servants doing this. And then, I mean, and that's kind of what the whole uprising's about anyways, in a way.
Interesting. I would never have thought of that.
How would you describe all of their outfits?
The one I remember the most is the spiderweb mohawk hat.
That was Toos, right? That was her name?
Toos, yep.
That's the one I remember. They're very, like, fancy space robes.
Fabulous is the word you're looking for.
And they all have face makeup that makes them look like those people who make themselves look like comic book characters.
Oh, my God. I was very close to, like, pausing the serial so that I could go get my eyeliner and do it. Like, it looks great.
I mean, I'm going to do that as a cosplay. I'm just going to draw those lines on my face, and that's going to be it.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is that those same contours, incidentally, I'm actually doing a piece, an art piece right now, for Alan's book.
Yay.
And I did one of these robots. The contours of the robot faces are the same as the contours of the makeup.
Yeah, I noticed that.
This is obviously like a facial. It's not like they've drawn it on. This is must be like a facial feature of these people. And so them having built robots, they build them in their own image.
Well, I was thinking that it was more that it was makeup, but it was they built the robots in the image of the fashion.
Okay, that's possible.
That's kind of was my thinking as I was doing it. It's kind of like their perception of beauty, you know, and then they make these robots that they perceive as very beautiful.
They are some pretty fancy robots.
Well, everything's very fancy on this. I'd love to see the budget for this. I mean, it really is quite elaborate for something in, when was this, 1970?
77, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, it was quite elaborate, especially because you think about all those, there's at least, what, five of those robots, and they're all fiberglass and all that. That wasn't cheap.
How would you describe the design of the robot mask, Joe?
It's a very, very fancy Guy Fawkes mask. It's okay. Green. Some of them are green, some of them are black.
They look like marble statues.
They look like they have like shiny cheeks. They don't look like robots. They look like, I don't know.
To me, they look like marble statue.
Yeah.
Like somebody made a marble statue mask and just...
Well, it looks very much like they're trying to make them not look like robots. You know, they're trying to make them pass as people. And it comes close, but not quite.
I think the robots look amazing. Their costumes are fantastic until you get to their feet where they look like they're walking on sticks of butter.
But, you know, if when you see close-ups of Dask's feet, he has the same boots. So they all, except for probably Toos and Zilda, they probably all look like that.
I always just thought they were really big Kiss fans.
Yes.
Apparently, on the documentary, the woman who did the costumes and everything wasn't that worried about the feet. And the director was like, I have a lot of shots where I can't reveal who it is. So I'm going to film their feet. And she was like, oh. And he's like, I want like silver feet. She was like, Oh no. So like she made these like silver things that they could like put on there, and every time they'd walk, they'd just like fall off. And so she's like furiously stabbing like pins into it to keep it on. So that was a last minute thing because the director was like, I want to film their feet. He's like, I could film their back, but I want to film their feet.
In the TARDIS, Leela is furiously concentrating on a yo-yo, and that's because she thought she was doing something to help.
She thought it was making the magic happen. The magic of the TARDIS was instrumentally part of the yo-yo. And the daughter's like, no, I just thought you'd have fun with it. I thought you were having fun with it. She's like, no! But also, he's like, it's not magic. And she's like, yeah, you're right. I remember the whole last serial.
You told me about science, I know. And then we get like a really amazing mind-bendy explanation of how the TARDIS works.
Yes, I love it so much.
One of the greatest scenes ever conceived for Doctor Who.
He gets two cubes. Which, why has he just got cubes hanging out?
For this reason.
Right, just in case anyone ever asks.
How does it work? And he's like, which one's bigger? And she points to the bigger one. And he's like, correct. He puts the big one on the TARDIS console and moves the other one closer to her. And he's like, now which one's bigger? She's like, it's still that one, you idiot. And he's like, but like, it appears bigger. And like, what if you could keep it here? And then like, but keep that one there, but like, put them together.
Just when that scene was happening, I was like, I guess?
But she gives him this look like he has lost his damn mind. And it's one of my favorite Leela moments ever. She just looks at him like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, I think she says something like, that's silly. And he's like, that's Time Lord technology that was amazing.
Like, no, it's silly.
I'm really disappointed that we hadn't gotten to Leela by the time we met her at Ulanta. Because it was like, cool, but I was like, I haven't gotten to her yet.
I don't really know who that is. Yeah.
So now it's like, in retrospect, I'm like, that was a cool experience.
I really think she's one of the best characters of Classic Who. She's one of the best character concepts. She was written well, had a great actress who understood the character. I just thought all the pieces just come together for that character.
I'm really enjoying her so far. I was slightly afraid of, I don't know, like, she's the sexy companion or something because she's got the, you know, sort of skimpy outfit thing going on. But it's not that at all.
But it was that. I mean, they did that because it came on after the news where you saw the football results and the men always hung around to watch the football results. And then they would stick around to watch the girl in the leotard. But the thing is, you take that sort of sexist start for this character, and when you watch her, she's this really well-conceived, really well-thought-out character. She's not just the nice legs, you know? She is a great character.
I've been really enjoying her so far. Mostly just because, like, I like her attitude of, like, but can I kill it?
There's no other character like her in the whole 55 years.
That's something I want to actually really like about this serial specifically. I mean, yeah, you could easily sexualize Leela because... But they don't. This whole serial doesn't have any real sort of, like, romance
aspect.
It's
never done in the text or anything.
Yeah, but, like, there's... I also like that this crew is, like, very... it's pretty diverse.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, that's true.
And there is, like, males and females, and there's no, like... I feel like there would be a tendency to be, like, and there's romance on the ship, and there's not, and I kind of like that.
No, what I love about it is that they're all, like, bitchy with each other.
Yes!
Yeah, they hate each other.
Like they're just stuck there for 2 years, and, you know, they're just gripey, and I love that. Their interactions with each other are so natural.
There was something that we said where, when we were watching this first episode, that I was like, I 100% believe that they have been, like, together way too long, and Joe said, yeah, they hate each other just the right amount. And I was like, that's it. That's exactly what it is. It's that, like, pleasant, polite, I fucking hate you.
And this is jumping ahead a little bit. It doesn't happen until episode 2, but there's a moment where, at the end of episode 2, where the sand miner goes off kilter and it's going to, like, crash or whatever, and they're in this, you know, emergency situation, and Poole and Toos are talking to each other over the intercom, and he's like, what's going on? And she's like, the motive drives have just, like, completely crashed, and everything's in danger, and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, okay, well, I'm going to go do this. Try to hold her steady. And she goes, oh, thanks, I would never have thought of that. And I'm like, that is so real. That is so, like, they're in the middle of this crisis, and yet she still has time to be bitchy back to him.
Yeah, everything about, like, this crew's interaction just feels very real.
Lived in.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It does an amazing job of filling the audience in on little aspects of who they are, what their society is like, just in them having conversations with each other. Not like they're doing an info dump to say, you know, we have to explain this to you so that the audience understands. They're just having conversations and the audience is listening to what they're saying.
What I think is great about the scenes where they're, like, talking to each other is also there's, like, clues to things. Because I didn't catch it necessarily the first time through, but I've been rewatching and making GIFs for the website. Whenever they're talking about robots, and one of them's like, I'm a robot racist or whatever.
Yeah, that's what he says.
Verbatim.
He's like, I wouldn't get a massage from a robot because it'd rip your arm off. And there's this other guy's like, robots don't work that way. And, like, the guy who always has robot knowledge, which would make sense for him to have robot knowledge because that's kind of his job on the ship, he's, like, saying all of the robot info in spoilers. He done it.
It's because he knows so much about robots.
He's the bad guy. I want to say when the TARDIS lands, they're inside something metal and they're going to go outside. But, like, Leela has this thing where she's like, are you telling me you don't know where the TARDIS is going to wind up? You have no control over this thing? And he's like, I have control over it. Like, 9 times out of 10. 7 times out of 5. Listen. And then that leads into another great bit where they're, like, heading out, and she's got the weird ball gun from Face of Evil. And he's like, don't take it. Weapons are bad. I don't like weapons. And he's like, what was it he said?
If people see that you don't mean them any harm, they won't hurt you, or something like that.
Which is terrible advice. But he's like, well, he says 9 times out of 10. I like that little callback. From what I've gathered from the Boosh, the mighty Boosh, is that he writes great dialogue. Super witty, super, super clever and good.
But one of the robots goes all red eyes. It's kind of like a glittery effect.
It's mostly effective.
I want to say it's color separation overlay and not an overlay, because it seems to move the right way.
Here's the thing. It, like, appears where it needs to, but also it bleeds over onto things that shouldn't be glowing red.
Probably a little bit of reflection, yeah. But one of the robots kills, I think it was the guy who was, like, saying that he didn't trust robots.
Yeah, the robot racist.
Chub,
yeah, it's Chub.
Chub. I mean, you know, you gotta rub out a Chub.
Good Lord.
I know, sorry, but, you know, the script wrote it, not me.
I mean, Joe started it, so I know where I know where the blame is. I know.
He flipped it, and now it's like, it means something entirely different. but yeah, there's something he's trying to get and it's stuck, and he orders a robot to come pick it out for him, and instead it, like, kills him.
It strangles him.
To death.
Which is, like, particularly violent, I feel like. There's no, like, zap and then the body's gone.
Yeah, for Doctor Who, there are a couple of grisly moments in this story.
I mean, in this era. I think that's the Hinchcliffe thing.
Yeah, I definitely understand why they started to get more and more complaints.
Well, and as it went on, as the series went on, you got more and more censors. I mean, it was censored more and more, and it was because of episodes like this and stories like this.
I think that's a bummer I feel like all of it, it's been, like, intense, but also fine. But meanwhile, there's some other robots that have found the TARDIS, and it's an adorable shot. It's like a crane game where they pick up the TARDIS.
A little robot hand comes by and cloop, and pulls it away.
I can never get those things on the first go.
I mean, you're not supposed to be able to. It's a whole thing.
It just slips right off.
You're also not a robot.
That's true. Or am I? Dun, dun, dun.
The one guy who found the body is trying to get the captain to call off.
That's Poole. Poole.
Poole. Poole is trying to get the captain to call off the mining.
Chief Mover Poole.
Chief Mover. I want to be a chief mover.
So they can
I
kind of
be a chief shaker.
I'd be a chief anything. I'm not picky.
What are you saying, sorry?
I have no idea. Just they're trying to call off the mining so they can kind of, like, investigate this murder that's happening. And the captain's, like, not having it. He's like, wow.
Money.
It's fine. We'll figure it out. If we stop now, it'll cost us money. So don't worry about it.
I think they eventually talk him into, like, well, look, there's, like, a murderer.
Like, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, they do talk him into it, apparently, because at the end of part one, he's all, get back to work, because we got to make money. At the beginning of part two, he's like, we got to solve these murders, because I don't want to get murdered myself or something. It seemed like a little switch there.
I think just occurred to him for the first time that, like, he could also be murdered. Also, I think at the beginning, he doesn't really believe, he's like, he just got, like, sick and died.
Oh, he was definitely strangled. Also, on the body is a little red poker chip. It's a corpse marker.
It's a bike reflector.
Oh, it is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. the guy who knows everything about robots explains what it is, which is you put it on defective robots, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, when they're being shipped back to the manufacturer to be fixed. It's a great plot device. It's a great little moment, where he has this explanation. It's a really cool notion. It's just like the guy who leaves pennies on the eyes of his victims or whatever. But I love that moment. I think it's really clever.
We also have in that moment where they're like all kind of in this room, like, well, it's one of us. Like, one of us is a murderer. Who is it? Which is always a fun
moment. There's a nice red herring as well with the red chip. Because, like, the one guy is picking it up and he, like, these two guys are arguing and he just, like, puts it on the hand of one of the other guys.
And he's the next person to turn up dead.
Yeah. And then, like, that looks real bad for that guy. Like, he was picking his next victim. Part of me was like, oh, man, it's got to be him, right? I was wrong. But also, there's a great line too here in this scene, too, where they're bickering and arguing. And, like, Zilda's arguing with some guy. She has, like, a slightly bat helmet on thing.
Yeah.
But someone interrupts her. The commander guy says, basically, don't interrupt Zilda, you don't interrupt your own, fancy rich class people.
Yeah, that's not how the ruling families treat each other.
And then Poole in the background is like, someone interrupted Chubb with two hands.
Too soon.
They do have a little dark sense of humor about this whole situation, which is great.
But I think there's something. I mean, that says a lot. You're talking about the bad guy and the way the guy that knows the robots is the bad guy and all that. But you also there's also something kind of suspicious about Poole because like he's going on like he's like, no, there's something else. We need to do this. And of course, you find out he's something else as well. But so there is kind of this like cat and mouse happening, too. And Poole's trying to move along a plot, not a plot in the story, but a plot in almost an espionage kind of plot. That's kind of this underlying thing as well, which is pretty cool as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts going on. I mean, it's really good.
Before we leave that scene too quickly, where they're all kind of grouped into that common room and they kind of like split off to go do their thing. And that is Michael Bryant, the guy who directed this story, had done he'd done like five or six Doctor Who's before Robots of Death. So he was kind of an old hand at this. But there's two really, really interesting moments that I had not ever noticed before until I rewatched it for tonight. Everything they do is in the studio, except when they're doing the model shots are done at Ealing Studio. But everything else is done at the BBC TV Center. And so everything's in the studio. But he takes two shots where he does sort of like aerial, like overview kind of shots looking down on the scene. One is in the TARDIS when the Doctor and Leela are leaving and you're looking down onto the console room. And the second one is at the end of this scene where you're looking down onto sort of the center of the room as you watch these people disband. That kind of like aerial shot is really, really unusual for Doctor Who in this period, partly because of the size of the studios and the constraint of the studio. You just don't normally have the option of sort of positioning a camera at that angle to get that kind of shot. So I think that he's really doing some interesting stuff throughout this story. But those two moments are the standouts to me because they're just so different from anything else that happens.
I think there's one more aerial shot, too, in the where there's that like upper deck with the
bridge.
Yeah, the bridge. I think there's one aerial shot in there, too.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, there is.
This whole episode is really well shot, too. There's a lot of good framing.
He's thinking in different angles than Doctor Who directors usually do.
Which is weird because this is the time the BBC was really restrictive on what kind of things could be done in terms of the studio. A few years later, a director would be fired for doing something like this. Or not fired, but never asked to come back. It's those kinds of things. And because he was doing really creative things, but he broke the rules of the shooting. And this, the same things here. Like, it was a big deal to do things like that at the BBC.
The Doctor and Leela kind of get out of the TARDIS, they go exploring, they get picked up by the robots. The robots sort of take them to, like, a holding cell.
Get interrogated a little bit.
Yeah, so they can figure out what's happening with them.
They find them and just assume, like, well, the commander assumes, oh, they must be the guy that killed, they must be the ones who killed Chubb. Let's go back to work.
Problem solved.
Gets everybody back to mining.
They're in, like, this waiting room, and the Doctor sonics his way out, and, like, we gotta go find the TARDIS. We'll sneak back in here so they don't realize we've left. But then he finds the silo, these, like, silos that are filling up with the sand that they're mining. And then he finds another dead body. I don't remember his name. Chubb 2. And he goes in there to look at the body, and the door shuts behind him and starts filling up.
This frightened me.
It looks like they legitimately covered Tom Baker with some sand.
Yes.
Beans.
I was concerned.
Beans. Yeah. It does look like... Is it beans? It looks like beans.
I always thought it was beans. If it wasn't beans, it missed a good chance to be beans.
But
That's the cliffhanger.
That's the cliffhanger. It's the end of episode
He's
one.
He's being buried alive.
He's bean?
That's a clever one.
Alrighty.
And, you know, and... It was just two stories ago that he was getting strangled and drowned. So this is a violent period for the show, and the Doctor's the brunt of it.
So we're now into episode two, which I have two titles for again. The first one is The Legend of Zelda.
I like that one.
Of course, that's an obvious
one. That's good.
And the other one is A Real Whodunit.
Ooh.
No.
Thank you. That is the correct response.
Legend of Zelda it is.
Normally... I'm the only one who has to do that.
But it is a real whodunit, you guys. So the Doctor has a snorkel.
That's how that cliffhanger is resolved.
He has a little pipe that he pops up through the beans, and he blows a couple out, and he's fine. Oh, when the beans, like, do start, like, they go away, and he's, like, uncovered, he makes the just, like, his hair is so flat, for one, which looks weird, and he's just so goofily happy. He's like, yeah.
Didn't die. Aces.
I was reading a thing today, one of the behind-the-scenes things, that Tom was not happy with that scene. He wanted to have a big action moment for the Doctor. He wanted to use his scarf as like a lasso and like swing himself to the door and kick it open himself rather than be rescued by the robot.
Oh, that's not as fun. He's wrong.
I saw something about that on the documentary. Not in as specific details of that, but Philip Hinchcliffe was like, yeah, apparently I don't think Tom Baker really cared for this serial altogether, the script for it. But he was talking about like he was wanting to do all these action things. And he's like, Tom Baker, I mean, he has a good idea, like... Every 1 in 10 suggestions.
Like, I really like that idea of the companion being a talking cabbage. That was a good one, but the rest of them were the worst.
But yeah, he's rescued by one of the robots.
We should mention their naming conventions.
There's Vs, there's SVs, which are
and
special
then there's
victims.
Dummies.
Dumbs.
There was a bit where they called the robot dumb, and I thought the guy was just being mean. I didn't realize that's what it actually stood for. You have Dumbs, Vox, and
Super Vox.
The Super Vox is the one that controls. He's like the head robot in charge.
And then you got the Vox, which are like underneath that, and they can talk. And then you got the Dumbs, who can't talk,
which are just the servant types. They're the menial ones.
Superbox and Vox are both green, right?
Yes.
Well, they're kind of silver and gold, aren't they?
Silver and green.
Are they green? I don't know. I always thought the green was just like me watching it on a really bad TV back in the 80s, and it just kind of was green. I always thought they were gold.
I remember seeing a gold one green. And a green one. I remember seeing two distinct, like, there was, and I thought it was like the different ones were different colors, because I remember seeing a goldish one. And, like, the rest of them seemed green.
Because the Super Vok is silver, right?
Sure.
I'm now completely uncertain.
Maybe I'm just really colorblind and I've never known it.
They're purple, actually.
But the Doms are black, right? They're the black.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. Best possible choice.
The black, silverish, green ones. Definitely that one.
So the black ones are the strong, silent types. Wow, Doctor Who. You haven't done that one before. I didn't even think about that.
Hmm.
Oh, well. I'm super looking forward to the next serial.
Yeah, leave that racism behind as we move into the next story. Great.
Okay, so yeah, the doctor is saved, but immediately put is like taken away because, hey, you were with a dead body.
He's pretty suspicious.
Then Leela is like roaming around herself, following people, sees the robots take out the one dead body. She goes into this other room, pulls a curtain aside, and the guy who got the chip put on him by the other guy is dead. Is he Indian? I think he's Indian, right? Which, I said this serial is diverse, but the diverse people don't last. Spoilers.
I mean, it's the 70s.
I mean, it's a pretty high body count.
That's true. That is also true. Not, they don't go first, though. That's good.
But, you know, none of them are called Chubb. So, if they had been, they would have been the first ones rubbed out.
So Leela finds this...
I'm gonna leave.
So Leela finds this dead guy. There's a robot in the room with her, one of the Doms, and he grabs her and then, like, covers her mouth and is like, hey, shh, don't give me up. And he's like, if I was gonna kill you, I would have killed you already. And at this point, I don't think we know that those type of robots are silent, because the commander comes in. Robots, like, I've basically got Leela, and then she's like, I'm not bad. I didn't kill this guy. Ask the robot. And then he's like, that robot is dumb. And that's when I thought he was just being mean. But what he really meant is that the robots can't talk.
Yes.
They get into a little bit of an argument. And he straight up slaps Leela. And she decks him. She kicks him down to the ground.
It was great. I enjoyed it.
And says, if you try that again, I'll cripple you.
She's hardcore.
She's the best.
Pool comes in and sort of breaks up anything getting any further violent, but also, like, everybody's, like, questioning and suspecting each other. And Pool at this point hints that he knows some shit about the commander. Because he's like, we all have our secrets, don't we? And the commander's like, and then leaves. I gotta be honest, some of this stuff, I didn't quite catch all of it in my first go-through. And I had to look some of it up on the Wikipedia to clarify things, because some of the plot points are, I'd say, a little bit rushed, or, like, spread out. The bits and pieces are a little bit spread out that I've forgotten what they were.
By the time it, like, became relevant, you forgot yeah. that information?
I honestly, when they revealed who the guy behind it all was, there was a second where I was like, I know his face, but I don't remember him as a character. Because there are a lot of characters to sort of keep track of.
Well, luckily, it gets fewer and fewer as the story goes along.
It's lucky that everybody dies. Everybody dies for my convenience.
The next scene is the doctor offering somebody a jelly baby.
Yes.
And the rudest thing happens.
He says, shut up, and slaps him out of his hand.
Just onto the floor. That was perfectly good candy.
I was like, could have just said no. And then they get questioned a little bit, and, like, there's a great bit where the commander's like, it's just a coincidence that all these dead bodies started piling up once you arrived? And the doctor just smiles for a second, and he's like, oh, I thought you were asking a hypothetical question. Yeah, it's just a coincidence. The dialogue is so good. The boosh.
It's almost Douglas Adams level.
So in that earlier scene with the commander and Pool arguing, there's a bit where, like, Pool says it could be somebody could be doing a double bluff. And then in this scene, the commander blames
the
doctor.
Doesn't know what a double bluff is, and he has to have it explained to him. And then in this scene, he's like,
you could be doing a double bluff, because he heard it 5 minutes ago.
It's funny, because if you watch the scene, Poole is all the way in the background. He is the farthest character from the camera, and he just sort of cracks up because he hears Yovanov pull his line that he had just explained to him.
I didn't notice that.
And he just you watch him. He laughs like, oh my God, what an idiot.
That's great.
That's fantastic. So the guy who knocked the stuff out of his hand, I'm going to call him Lee Pace because he reminds me a bit of Lee Pace.
Alrighty.
I don't remember his real name. The doctor, like, insults him and says that he, what is it, the inverse ratio of...
the size of the mouth to the size of the brain.
The Lee Pace guy just smiles at him, walks over, and then just starts strangling him.
And strangles him. Like, is that not the stupidest move you could make?
And that's the same guy who put the chip on the other guy, too. He is not making things look good for himself.
He's not making good choices.
Everybody's probably tried to strangle the doctor at least once. It happens.
Oh, man, yeah, there's this scene where the commander gets all up in Zilda's face about how he's going to be richer than her family. He is, like, right up here, noses almost touching.
Too close to her. There's too much touching. I, like, seethe when I'm watching something where somebody's touching somebody and they clearly don't want to be touched. It's like a thing that, like, I mean, it's, you know, what's supposed to be happening, but it's so effective for me in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm just like, stop it! Ugh! I hate it so much.
Then one of the people, we don't see who because we just see their feet, gives a robot one of the markers and says, kill Zilda. I think, actually, if you're paying close enough attention, you can tell who it is because he's wearing his clothes.
Yeah, it shoots his feet, but you can see the bottom of his pants, and so you can tell what costume it is, sadly.
If you're paying attention,
I was not.
I was not paying close enough attention to be like, oh, that's that guy. Got it. I was just like, look at those weird butter shoes. So the doctor and Leela get locked up in these cardboard metal things. They look like they're cardboard wrapped in aluminum foil.
I mean, sure.
Bands.
But there's one around, what, the this torso one, and one around one, the neck?
Yeah. And the doctor points at his own head and says, I'm thinking of ways to get out of this. I'm going through all the combinations. And Leela's like, how long's that going to take? He's like, 3 weeks. There's a lot of combinations. She's like, you're not taking this seriously. He's like, no, I am. I'm taking it very seriously. 3 weeks seriously. Pool comes in to talk to the doctor and Leela because he doesn't think they did it and sort of talks about what it could be. And the doctor has a theory that it's robots. And he's like, you can't be robots because...
because Isaac Asimov says so.
Them's the rules.
Yeah, man.
And then he's like, it's impossible. And the doctor says the same thing that 3 said in a previous serial, and is also the opening to Jerry Seinfeld B-movie, which is that bumblebees are
it's impossible for them to fly, but they do anyway. It's not impossible. They just use the wrong formula when doing the math. It's for a fixed wing instead of rotating wing.
Mm-hmm.
I Googled it one day. Because I had nothing better to do. It's not impossible. They just did the math wrong.
But the doctor is rather fond of bumblebees. I don't know if Jerry Seinfeld is.
Jerry Seinfeld's not a fan of a lot of things. He complains about a lot of things in his stand-up. But they get let loose and are going to go investigate things. They're going to go investigate Chubb's murder crime scene. And then that's when, like, the doctor's like, imagine you're in Chubb's position. This stuff is... there's this emergency going on. You need to get this package. What would you do? And he, like, grabs the package and it won't move. And he's like, well, what would you do since it's stuck? And he's like, I'd call a robot.
And the camera zooms in on his face as he has the realization.
Yeah, he would have done a robocall.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's brilliant.
Oh, man, I love when other people are on here. It's great.
They call me out so you don't have to?
Yeah. Normally, it's just, like, me and my disappointment.
Zilda breaks into the commander's bedroom. He has a really nice painting on his wall. I just really like that painting. I thought it was her room at first, and I was like, she's got some sweet digs. But no, she's broken into his room, and she finds something out, and then gets on the intercom and is all like, he did it! He's the bad guy!
He's a murderer.
Yeah.
And then she gets murdered.
And the commander finds her dead. He has this kind of gross line. It's like, she might have liked me if I was rich. Which,
it's like, you
no.
could have tried just not being an ass.
Yeah.
No one ever thinks to try that.
No, that doesn't work.
But Pool comes in and sees him with her and is like, thinks that he's just caught him red-handed.
Yes.
Well, he does look very suspicious.
The commander's like, I didn't do it. Get out of my way. And he shoves Pool a little bit. And then Pool just like decks him to the ground. The commander gets knocked to the ground a lot. It's fun. So then Leela gets a premonition of, she's like, I feel like something's wrong.
Yeah, she just kind of gets vibes, I guess.
Is that a thing with her, or is that just this serial only?
No, it's supposed to be like
instincts.
Animals sense danger before it happens. Exactly.
Oh, okay. And then everything goes sideways. Literally. The ship veers, and then everybody falls down. And then everything is, like, failing. And there's a robot that very casually says, like, hey, this is the percentage of things that are fucked up.
Things are 90% bad.
And the doctor rushes in and is like, let me take control of things, please. I can fix this. He's like, we gotta cut the power.
It's like, I'm just one technobabble away from fixing it all.
But hey, in the David Tennant era, he would run in the room and wave his magic wand and it would all fix.
And then say, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry.
Only after he would brag about how smart he is.
And then someone died.
At least this doctor has to come in and have an idea of mechanically what's wrong and how to fix it.
But he is stopped by, what's the bad guy's name?
Oh, Lord.
Dask.
Dask. Well, he gets a different name later, too. But yeah, he gets stopped by Dask, and that's the cliffhanger, is things are not doing great. That's the end of episode 2. We are now into episode 3, which I've called The Substitute.
No backup.
No backup.
No substitute.
I couldn't think of any more puns on the characters' names because I didn't remember them.
That does make it difficult.
What's a good pun for Dask?
I don't know. I don't do the puns.
The Dask of Dandragora.
I do the pun reactions. That's how this thing is structured.
Ooh, Dask. The Mask of Dask.
Ooh.
That's pretty good.
Thank you. Of death. The doctor's like, do the thing I said, and he does. Dask does it, actually. He cuts the thing. Cuts the power to the ship, and everything's better? Not great, but not, we're gonna die immediately.
They're not actively falling apart anymore. They're more, right, like, without power now.
Yeah, now they're just sinking.
Yeah, which is actually a pretty good effect, the model sinking.
Most of the model work is actually pretty good in this one.
Yeah, it's really good.
The only thing I don't think, like, super works is when they do the outside shot of the window, and you can see them all walking around in there, and it's like very...
But that was so advanced for its time. I mean, it may not be convincing now in the CGI era and the, you know, we have high-def televisions and they didn't in 77, but for then, I thought it was really good.
I had this weird moment in like the very first episode when they first did it where I gasped and went, there are tiny robots in there! It took like a whole minute for my brain to gear up and be like, no, they're in a, it's a model that it's supposed to be big. And I was like, oh, right. Okay. I just thought it was a thing full of tiny robots for like half a minute.
They do. Was that still the model that they did that with? Was it just like a model with like a green screen on it or something?
I think so. Yeah.
Because at that time they were doing a lot of like, what do they call it? This thing, they did it in the, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy miniseries, which was a few years later, but they would make these gigantic paintings and like put it over the camera and they'd shoot through it, so they'd like leave a space like empty where they'd call it like a, it's like a mask kind of like, yeah, like in like Photoshop or whatever, they'd call it a mask, but it's the same thing that they did, except they did it on a very large scale back then.
So instead of like a matte painting, it's something that's in the background, it's like in the foreground.
Matt, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. My mind's not working today, but yes, it's a matte. And they did that a lot, but I don't know. I think this was the model with like a green screen. They just kind of laid it in there, but yeah, they would do that a lot too at that era.
They're sinking. Everything is broken, including Tusa's wrist, which gets bandaged up by Leela.
Which is a sweet moment.
Yeah, because there's also a moment when the doctor comes in at the end of that scene, and it's just like, did you do that? Nice.
Yeah, he's
like very proud.
Proud
of her. I was like, aw, they're cute. Also in that scene, Pool is basically just like, it's got to be the commander. He's the bad guy. He killed a dude once. He left him out in a storm to die. And also it was Zilda's brother? Is that what Zilda saw?
Yes. I don't know what it was that he left laying around in his room that has this incriminating information.
I imagined it was his captain's log.
Don't put that stuff in there. Just leave out incriminating.
Well, maybe it was like his personal journal. He's like, I cry about this every night as I go to sleep. I'm a very sensitive person. I just have to have such a hard exterior.
It's his private Tumblr side blog.
Oh, no.
I'm really sensitive inside.
This is some of the stuff that I didn't fully grasp all of it. So when, like, pieces of it start coming together at the end, I was a little bit like, I don't know what they're talking about. Because, like, it happens, like, towards the end of episode 4. And I, like, this is one small scene where this bit is set up. I remember he said that he killed Zilda's brother, but I didn't remember how he did it, which was that he didn't really kill him. He left him out. He went outside and he didn't save him. So it was death through an action rather than death through, like, stabby stab or something.
Stabby stab.
The ship gets fixed and then rises up. The Doctor and Leela both think that Pool is being a liar. They think he's up to something, that he's not telling the truth. So they sort of suspect him of being the guy behind all this stuff. Leela takes that opportunity to basically sit down and question Pool. She does it really well, too. She just, like, casually having this conversation with Pool. Just, like, slips in all these questions about, like, so where are you from? What are your motives? And he gives some, you know, fairly stock answers. And, like, I'm here for the money, and you do what you can. And anyway, I'm gonna go. Bye. Stop questioning me. And then locks her in the room. Which, that's real suspicious.
Yeah, he's super suspicious.
Well, he moved like a hunter.
Oh, yeah, she did say that.
Yeah, she called him out. She's like, he's always watching. Which I don't think the performer really conveyed that.
No, he's more just sort of funny. He'd make a lot of, like, offhanded, humorous remarks and then just sort of lounge around, chuckling in the background. Dask is, like, examining the robots as well, and Pool comes in to check on the robots as well. Dask leaves, Pool's, like, looking at it, presses this button that causes the wall to spin, and there's a damaged robot that's got blood on his hand.
That's the really kind of, like, gruesome scene that I was thinking of earlier. It looks like fresh meat on his hands. It's disgusting.
It's horrific.
It's awesome.
And then Pool just loses it. He just, like, goes, no, no, please, no, and is grabbing his hand and screaming, and I'm like, what the hell is happening? That also makes me feel like he might be the bad guy, and it's, like, something controlling him or something. It turns out to be something else, which we don't find out until the next episode.
He's got robophobia.
He's broken.
Yeah, from one bloody robot hand. He loses his shit. I don't know how I feel about the robophobia thing. I don't know if it's, like, an interesting thing or a stupid thing.
You can't tell?
I can't decide. Like, part of me's like, that's really stupid, but I don't want to be, like, derogatory about somebody's illness.
I don't want to be insensitive.
Exactly.
Not about people who have robophobia.
I mean, here's the thing. If it suddenly turned out that something that's in every single person's home, like, say, a microwave, suddenly started killing you, and you realize that any microwave around you could all of a sudden kill you, that would be kind of an impactful thing, I think.
I could take a microwave.
Okay, fine, but I'm... As an example.
Maybe if it was like an oven, then I'd be scared. But I could take a microwave.
Well, and I think the description of robophobia that the doctor gives, it's something along the lines of when you realize these things that have these human features are all of a sudden doing these evil things, and you can't, like, separate that. And it's this idea that you think of it as an manufactured object, but all of a sudden they start killing, and it's horrifying, and sometimes brains can't deal with it.
I think also it's the idea that they sort of occupy the space between, like, person and inanimate object in a way that inherently makes people very uncomfortable.
The uncanny valley?
Yeah.
And their design, like, we've already talked about this, but their design, I get the impression they're designed to mimic the culture. They're designed to mimic the fashions of the culture and those kinds of things.
They're so ubiquitous in this society. Everything relies on the robots. So when they become dangerous, that could be terrifying.
Okay.
How do you feel?
I feel a little bit better about it. I just feel like the fact that he just saw a hand dipped in blood. I don't feel like that's enough evidence to go, oh no, the robots are evil. I mean, I guess there's been some building evidence that leads to that, but...
And certainly, if he's the guy that someone has sent in to investigate this situation, he should be a little, maybe, sterner in his constitution.
The way that the doctor explains it, though, it's that it's kind of like, it's something that was kind of like, he's always been kind of afraid of him. Mm. And like, that is something that like triggered like an PTSD event. And yeah. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think, though, it would have made more sense for the guy who was like robot racist that we talked about earlier to just like get it, you know? There wasn't anything that led us to believe that he was distrustful of robots. And on the other hand, he has like a best friend that he's been hanging out with that is a robot that he's been secretly like hanging out with on this liner.
And that is apparently his job, is not only to like work with robots, but to like investigate robots that like might be broken.
He's like the FBI of robots.
He just really picked the wrong job.
He was trying to confront his fear and it backfired. Then SV7, who's been kind of like the main robot, green, gold, whatever color robot.
Yeah, he's the silvery one.
Yeah, he gets like a phone, like a video call from whoever's doing all this, and I still can't tell who it is because there's like this effect on. And, like, I probably should have recognized his face there, but I didn't. So I'm still in the dark at this point about who it is.
Guys, I did not figure it out. I did not know till the show told me.
That's awesome.
And he starts giving him orders, giving SV7 orders. There's, like, this, like, it cuts back and forth between the weird effect face of Dask and the robot's face. And it just, like, keeps cutting back and forth really, really fast. And it's very unsettling.
Oh, yeah, it made me almost feel nauseous.
It's almost like a Time Lord effect. Contact.
And then the robot's, like, orders accepted, starts glitching, and then it's
unsettling.
Very unsettling. And then Dask basically says, "You are one of us." And it's like, one of what? The dumb robot, D84 is his name, is examining the body of Zilda, who's, like, laid out in this room. And he, like, covers it up with a blanket. It's very nice. But, like, the doctor is hiding behind this curtain. And he, like, dramatically slashes it aside while giving the biggest, goofiest grin ever.
I would describe his face as manic.
And he's like, "What you doing, robot?" He's like, he doesn't say anything because he's not supposed to. And he's like, "Well, I guess I better go tell the head robots that you can talk." And then he's like, "Please don't do that." And then they become buds.
I love this robot so much.
This is one of my favorite stories from way back from when I was a kid. And when I listened to it before, I'm also a massive Beatles fan. And as I was listening to this when I was young, I was just like, is that Ringo Starr doing the voice of D84? I mean, it obviously wasn't, but that like strong, almost Liverpool accent that comes through. And I just love it.
He's so sweet. He's just a little sweetheart.
And meanwhile, Dask in his robot KKK hood.
All right.
Injecting a robot. That scene is super creepy too. Like he takes the face off of the robot and it's just like, it's just weird bits and pieces, but like his hands are like
twitching.
And he like holds his hands and is like, "I'm going to make you free."
And also like the thing he has is like freedom. This big needle that he just like
dabs into like the open face.
Ugh.
And injects him with that red glitter stuff. It's so disturbing.
Yeah, is this where he's calling them brother? He's like, "Yes, brother."
Yes.
Brother. This is when you find out his name. Is this when you find out he's Taron Capel?
Yeah, the next scene is the doctor and D84 chit-chatting about like why D84 is there, which is he's investigating stuff. We don't know that he's with Poole yet. Actually, I think he did tell the doctor, but it happens off camera, so we, the audience, don't know until later. I think the doctor might know. But yeah, he starts talking about, what did you say his name was?
Taron Capel. I want to sing it in the way that you sing Cruella de Vil.
Yes!
Go for it, do it.
Right now, please.
Let's see. I think every time I've been on this podcast, I've sang. It's usually the Haroon, yeah. I don't even know, it would be like, Taron Capel, if you're a robot, well, you're all going to hell. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. Every time I hear it, I just hear it in the tune of that song.
Beautiful, beautiful.
That's one thing that I feel like might be a slight negative thing about this serial is maybe bring this guy up episodes earlier.
Like two would be good.
Like at least a mention of him. Like it's kind of weird that it's dropped halfway through episode 3. Basically, He was a robot scientist what lived with robots. Was he raised by robots? Is that what was said?
That, I think that's the indication, yes. Well, tell me this. How long, and it's only, I've watched this story for years, but it's only really occurred to me now. How long have they been on this mining vessel?
It says that they're on a 2-year tour, but I don't know how far in the 2 years that they are, but it has to be a while because they're with the bitchiness.
So that means that this guy has just been like hiding this for like at least like 6 months. At the very least, 6 months, and Poole has been there for 6 months or 2 years or a year or a year and a half or whatever. And man, these guys are really good at keeping secrets.
On a small, I mean, it's not a huge ship. It's big, but it's not infinite.
Yeah, and why did he choose right now? Is it just like he's getting all of his ducks in a row?
Maybe they were towards the... I got the impression they were towards the end of the mission, but...
I think they are, too, because when they're doing the mining scenes, they're really concerned about we're gonna end up going home with only half our capacity. And if they were near the beginning, they wouldn't be as worried about that, because there would still be plenty of time to fill the coffers with whatever it is they're doing.
Well, maybe it's like they're going across a wilderness, basically, of nothing. They have enough supplies for that or whatever. So he wants to make sure that we at least get close to civilization again so he can get out.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I think the story tells us that it's towards the end, but the situation tells us it's probably somewhere like 6 weeks into it. Because in 6 weeks, you're already getting tired of the people, right? It's a small enclosed place. It's long enough to keep a secret, but not so long where you're kind of like, when's this murderous guy going to come out? So I don't know. I mean, that's never occurred to me until this conversation that, man, these guys were just kind of hanging out with these guys and had no clue who they were.
The timing is a little weird. I'm going to have to rewatch it and, like, figure it out. Or look at the Wikipedia, one of the two.
Nah, it doesn't tell you.
So, but no one knows what this Taryn Capel looks like.
I like that. Like, in the future, where it's like, will you investigate this guy? We're not going to send you a picture of him.
Well, the idea is that there wasn't a picture of him. Like, he had never been seen. And that was the whole thing. It wasn't the doctor saying, well, I mean, you got on here and you're not who you say you are.
Yeah, because he's like, it could be somebody. He's like, no, it's not somebody because we know who all these people are. And he's like, did you ever think that maybe he's pretending to be somebody else? And the robot's like, oh no, and like goes into a corner and is like, I have failed.
My poor robot child.
Oh.
Tony loves robots so much. How do you feel about D84? You love him so much.
Yeah.
When I was much younger watching this, I always really wanted D84 to become a companion. It almost feels like they're setting him up for that.
Well, and apparently what I've read this afternoon is that the guy who plays D84, he and Tom Baker, like, just struck up this amazing friendship, and he kept hoping that that's how it was going to go. Like, I could be the next robot companion.
At that point, he would have been the first robot companion.
Yeah, Leela was only going to stick around until the end of this season. So just, what, 13 episodes? 3 serials. So if he had gone on the next story with them, she would be gone after that, and he would keep on. That's what he was hoping for.
Yeah, and then K-9 came on.
K-9.
But, I mean, could you imagine D-84 in the Talons of Wang Chiang? Like, with a hat, a bowler hat? Like, I don't know. I love the idea of D-84 as a companion. Like, it felt like they were setting him up for that.
What I would be kind of down for is, like, a spinoff that's, like, Pool and D-84, like, as, like, a detective robot.
A buddy comedy, exactly. It could be 48 hours, but with those two guys.
Or, like, Chips.
Yeah, or like they're, like, it's, like, a detective and his assistant, and, like they're doing, like, noir-esque space crimes.
Man, I want to write that now. Like, that's just super fun.
This one needs a good name, so we can add it to the pile. So I mean, we can add it to Family Unit and
Agents of Web. I mean, the thing I think of is Pool and D84, but
I was gonna just say Pool and D
or D Pool.
Dumb Investigations.
No, what happens next?
You don't like Dumb Investigations?
We'll get there.
All right.
I think we're up to the scene where SV7 comes into Tuce's room. Is that right? and it looks like he's going to bend down and strangle her. But she wakes up, and she's like, her bed is like this like huge clamshell.
I want that bed.
I do too.
Like she's Venus de Milo or some shit. Like,
oh yeah, she's lounging the heck out of it.
I like that though, that like you see from the point of view of the robot, and you think he's going to strangle her. Then she wakes up. And he's like, oh, I have information. So you think she's going to get strangled, but it doesn't happen. But it kind of happens later. But he's basically trying to get her to go somewhere. And she's like, go get Leela for me. My wrist hurts. And he's like, I will take you to the medical bay. And she's like, no, bring Leela to me. Listen to me, stupid robot.
He's like, oh, okay.
The doctor is sneaking around in a hallway. We also see that Leela is like banging on it. She's still stuck in that room. I forgot she was stuck in that room at that point, and they cut back to her. I was like, oh, right, she's still in there. We've had, like, five scenes without Leela, and I forgot that she was stuck in a room, but she's banging on it and yelling. But then we cut to the doctor, like, sneaking around. D-84 grabs him on the shoulder, and the doctor's like, ah! And then the robot goes, I heard a cry. And he's like, that was me! And they walk a little bit further down the hallway, and he goes, I heard a cry! That was me. I heard a cry. That was me. And he walks off, and then the robot stands there for a second and just goes, I heard a cry.
That is a good scene.
Oh, I love it so much.
He gets more and more mad.
And see, could you imagine that as like Doctor and Companion for like a whole season? That would be amazing.
It's almost like, oh my God, our episode is 30 seconds too short. What can we fill it with?
You say that. I know for a fact writers do scenes like that to pad out time.
He says as a writer.
I've been watching The Simpsons and listening to the commentaries, and they're like, we always do that like scene with like Bart and Lisa going like, you know, arguing back and forth. Like, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And they're like, we'll just pad that out if time, we need more time. Or like Kang and Kodos laughing, they just pad that out if they need to fill up more time. That's less and less of an issue now that there's more commercials and less time to actually do story. But back in the day, they did that a lot. But then this scene really made Tony angry. The head robot is like, meets up with the other evil robots and has corpse markers and is like assigning murders. And then like, you kill this person, you kill Leela. He like specifically says the names, and he's got two left, and then he goes, and I will kill the others. You're like, no!
I wanted to figure out who it was!
That's some clever writing
They thought it through.
So this robot goes to kill Leela. They get into a fight. She, like, karate chops him, and it does nothing. And she runs, and she takes her knife and chucks it at him. And it lands inside the robot, making the most cartoonish twang noise I've ever heard.
And then he just brushes it aside.
On the documentary, she said when she threw that knife, she almost hit a cameraman with it.
Oh, no.
On take one. Take two, everyone left except for the cameraman. Then she defeats the robot temporarily because he's like, you will not escape. You will not escape. And then she throws a curtain on him and escapes. Why are robots so easily defeated by blankets?
And stairs.
I mean, I'd get confused if you threw a blanket over me.
Are you a bird? Like, oh, it's nighttime.
It's night. Yeah. As soon as I get under the blankets, I'm just sleepy. I just lay down and take a nap.
So the doctor finds the workshop that Dask has been using, finds the big glitter needles.
That is a good point. So he kept his workshop secret for months.
He kept the secret workshop on this pretty small. I mean, it's big, but it's still confined. And is it just like behind a wall? Like, didn't someone not know there was this extra space in the thing there? Had no one looked at the schematics? Hey, maybe we could use this room to get a little more space since we're so cramped. And they go in there, and it's just like a laboratory of dead robots.
But also, if you look at the equipment, it's got the brand name on the side of the big thing. It's called the Laserson, the drill. If you watch the new version of Shada, when the doctor goes into the TARDIS in like episode 5 or something, and he goes into the TARDIS workshop, and you see all these bits and pieces on the shelves behind him, one of them is that Laserson scalpel thing.
Huh. Huh. Oh,
nice.
Yeah, so he obviously kept a memento from his adventures on the sand planet.
So he's like, I found all this stuff. I need to talk to Toose. And the D-84 gives him a little microphone communicator thing. And he calls Toose and says, the robots are doing it. Get to the bridge or whatever. And we'll deal with this. And she tries to leave the room, but there's a robot right outside her door. He reaches in for her, and she shuts the door on him. And the doors, like, close on his hand. And he's, like, trying to grab her. And she just starts smacking it with, like, this vase or something. And knocks his hand clean off.
Which sets up to the best scene in this entire set.
He basically removes his arm from the hand. He leaves the hand behind. She doesn't knock it off of him. He just disconnects from it. Which I think is really cool. He's like, well, I'm not going to get in, so I'm just going to cut my losses, my loss being my hand.
So she calls the doctor back and says there's a robot outside, and D-84 is going to go help her.
D-84, by the way, is like, I can go. I'm very fast. The doctor's like, okay. And he's like, great. I want to help. I love helping. He's very cute.
Meanwhile, Leela has hidden from the other her specific assassin robot on that, like, turntable wall thing in the robot cupboard. I don't know what you call it. And then she finds Pool in there, who's hiding under a table, freaking out. He starts yelling, she's in here, she's in here, like, gonna give her up. And she's like, hey, calm down. Don't give me up. I'll leave you alone to be all weird in here. But the commander guy shows up at the workshop, sees the doctor, and is like, oh, this is all you're doing. You've got all this evil stuff. The robot walks up behind the commander, and the doctor's like, you should probably come over here with me, or you're going to get stabbed by a robot. And then he comes over there, and he's like, the doctor very casually is like, he's tracked us down by this thing or this thing, depending on which one of us he wants to kill first.
Yeah, he's like, he's either here to kill me or you.
Yeah.
It's 50-50. I'm not sure which.
And he just drops that line so casually. I love it so much. It's so hilarious. Like, he's just, like, talking about, you know, normal everyday thing when an evil robot is, like, headed his way. He's like, I'm not sure which it is. We'll find out. And the robot comes up and strangles the doctor. And that's the cliffhanger.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's the end of episode 3. We are now into episode 4, which I have called Robophobia.
Okay. You just got bored thinking of
puns,
things, or trying?
Yeah, I gave up. It was too hard.
Oh.
Oh, wow. Wow.
The noose of Toose. I don't know.
You know what? Robophobia is fine. Let's move on. Don't hurt yourself.
So then the commander grabs one of the Laserson scalpel needle things and just jams it in the back of his head. Not the doctor's, the robot's head. And the robot's like, and has a power failure and falls down.
Is this the scene? It might not be. I don't remember in what order they're coming. Is this the one where he's killed the doctor, and he gets the thing jammed in his head, and then he just goes, kill, 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 kill,
kill, kill, kill.
That is so creepy. I love it.
Robots repeating stuff is always creepy. Repeating things is creepy in general.
Yeah, repeating things is creepy.
Yeah, midnight.
Repeating things is creepy. Repeating things is creepy. And sometimes repeating things is sad. Binary, binary, binary.
No! why would you?
I'm sorry.
I think the real question is, why wouldn't he?
The robot gets the door open, Toose's door open, and comes in and straight up strangles Toose. Like, it was really... There's been a handful of stranglings.
That was unsettling, yeah.
This one was, like, the most
It was, like,
unsettling.
From the robot's point of view, and, like, it went on for a very long amount of time.
It was just filler. They were filling the episode.
Yeah, stretch. We have to stretch.
Let's stretch this scene out. Let's just strangle her for a really long time.
She's being strangled in her own clam bed. Oh, man, later, too, because she doesn't die, but she has, like,
bruises on her neck.
Yeah.
Yeah, she got roughed up in this story.
My next note says the doctor carries the commander. Why is he carrying him?
Because, you know, the robot tried to kill him or whatever, and so the doctor's carrying him to safety.
He sprained his ankle or something, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah, and they're going down the hallway, and the robots kind of, like, you know, surround them.
Including the malfunctioning head stab robot.
The one that's just slowly repeating kill over and over again.
And the doctor tricks this malfunctioning robot by putting his hat and scarf on another robot. Question, has the Doctor worn his hat at all in this serial?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think he had. He's carrying it around with him, but he's not worn it the entire time.
Here's something that we haven't talked about either, is how polite the robots are. Because when this robot starts killing the other robot that is dressed like the Doctor, he goes, "Please do not kill me. Please do not kill me. Please do not kill me." I mean, it's so polite.
Very reminiscent of Portal.
That sort of chipper but deadly, like the...
It's me!
What, the turret guns?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised that worked, but it's
funny. But it's fine.
Funny. It's funny.
Okay, now, there's a split in the scene where Toos is getting strangled. You know, it cuts to the Doctor and the Commander in the hallway, and then they come back to the robot finishing the job on Toos. And the robot's got blue eyes.
See, I always thought that they just forgot to use the...
That's what I wonder, too. If they, like, it was supposed to be CSO, and the blue, I'm sure that's what it is, the blue was supposed to be replaced by the red glitter.
Because back then they used blue screens for all of those things, yeah.
I didn't even really notice that.
I didn't notice either, but that's probably 100% what happened, is they just forgot to flip that switch. I thought she was dead, but she's not dead.
She just gets up like, it got better.
Well, the D-84 comes in to help her and is, like, looking her over. And Leela comes in and is, like, sees this robot over Toos.
The best scene in the entire story.
The best written scene ever.
Picks up the hand off the floor and she chucks it at him.
And again, super polite. "Please do not throw hands at me." It might be one of the best lines in Doctor Who history.
Absolutely is. Absolutely.
I would have agreed with you until Eat My Salad Halloween.
Well, I mean, it was one of the best until that.
That's the most bizarre, weird... This is a very bizarre, weird scene, and that's what I love about Doctor Who, is the bizarre, weird... What are you doing?
What are you doing? I mean, I'm here for it. That's fine.
And I think that's what makes these robots so unhuman, you know? Because they don't know how to speak. Their lines don't make sense sometimes. I mean, I guess that makes sense. But, you know, a human would be like, "Don't throw things at me." But the robot's so literal, it's, "Please don't throw hands at me." And the same thing with the "please do not kill me." It's these kind of things.
There's a disconnect.
They don't express the way humans would.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes these robots so creepy.
I like that it can be creepy, but it can also be funny. And sometimes both at the same time.
Oh, it definitely is funny. I mean, that line is incredible.
Also throwing hands is like an expression too, right?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. Is it? Yeah, I think so.
I think so.
It is. Of, like, "I'm going to throw my hands. I'm going to fight you.
You're going to catch these hands, too. Tell you what." but, like, they quickly get it settled. Like, "I'm not an evil robot. I'm here to help." But Leela and Toos are, like, getting away. And they hide inside of the hopper, the silo thing. Two robots come out and they're like, "We should search in here." And the other one's like, "We already did that." And he's like, "Oh, okay." And they just walk away. Very lucky.
Convenient.
They couldn't have just ducked in here after we searched it.
They're too literal. That's their flaw. They're robots.
And then I like Toos is like, "Robots can't harm humans." And Leela's like, "And I can't harm robots.
I tried. I threw a whole knife at one."
Toos gets contacted on the communicator by SV7. And, like, he's like, first off, he's like, "Who is this?" And she's like, "It's Toos." And he's like, "Where are you?" And she's like, "I'm at..." And Leela's like, "Shh, shh, 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 what are you doing?" And then they realize that can't be SV7 because it asked who she was.
And they, like, all have, like, voice imprints. They recognize everybody's voice.
Right.
Like my Google does.
So, but they all do eventually get to the command deck. D-84 also brings in Pool, like he's collected him from the robot cupboard. This is where we find out that Pool and D-84 are secret agent buddies.
When he has Pool, by the way, he's like, "Pool is broken. I don't know why."
It's because he's got robophobia. And then we get the whole explanation of robophobia. And I believe this is also where we get the explanation of what happened with the commander. And because he's like, "I saw this once before, and this guy got robophobia, ran out, and died." He's like, "I tried to stop him, but it didn't work." So you've g- get the whole story behind that thing.
And robophobia is referred to as Grimwade syndrome, which refers to Peter Grimwade, who's the production assistant on here, who griped that every time he did a Doctor Who, it always had robots.
That's wonderful. I love that bit of trivia. They get a call from the SP7 guy who's like, you've got 5 minutes, arbitrarily giving you 5 minutes to give up. Why don't they just, like, why do bad guys give good guys time limits?
I mean,
just do it. Kill them. Just go do the thing right now. You know how many of your evil plans would work if you didn't have some ridiculous countdown? All of your plans would work if you didn't have a ridiculous countdown. Anyway.
You've got no sense of style.
I'm about results, Tony.
You know, now that the scene we're talking about is back on the bridge set, it's so unusual to have, like, multi-level sets like this. You know, where you've got, like, stairs that go up to a second level in a scene that's, like, in a house. In the studios that they had were kind of small. It was unusual to have that kind of, you know, height. So it's really interesting to see the way that they've done that.
And they have that, like, big display, too, that, like, has, like, computer readouts and stuff on it. Sometimes looks like it just looks like an error screen. But
it does. That set has, like, a real sense of depth to it.
It reminded me of the set from Planet of Evil. Is that the one I'm thinking of? Because they also had, like, multiple levels. And they had those, like, clear, those, like, see-through tables and stuff,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. I think it was Planet of Evil. And there's another one, another Leela one coming up next season that's similar.
I always really like shows that do something like that, that have, like, that, like, their set design is different than you would imagine. Because, like, a lot of things are very left to right.
Well, when the TARDIS got the, like, the glass floors.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was great.
I love, like, the lower level and the upper level in the TARDIS. They don't do that often enough. Like, Levin just, like, underneath it, like,
fidgeting with stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. But yeah, like, in, like, Firefly, you've got two levels on it as well, like, on Serenity. I love that. That's actually something I kind of liked about the apartment on Seinfeld, too, because, like, a lot of, like, sitcom apartments are left to right, but, like, Seinfeld's apartment had depth to it. You had the living room up front, then, like, a dining room behind it, and then, like, his bedroom behind that. And it's very rare that you see that on television, like, depth. I like when set design has depth.
If someone asked me, when you do your review of Robots of Death, what classic sitcom do you think will get referenced more than once? I would never have guessed Seinfeld.
It's relevant both times.
I mean, if I had to guess any TV show, it would have been Farscape.
That one gets brought up a lot.
I'm usually trying to fit one Farscape reference in there.
This one's been your most forced one yet.
Fair enough.
So this is when it's fully revealed that Dask is the bad guy. Cruella De Vil.
Taryn Capel.
Taryn Capel.
Did you say Cruella De Vil?
I did. I said Cruella De Vil. Now he has green makeup on his face because he is he's been SV7, right? He was dressed up like SV7.
I think he's just like, he's just got himself like, I think, roboted up.
Yeah, he identifies more with robots than with people. But he's got the SV7 outfit on, basically.
Because I think that's why, I think he was the one that was talking to.
Yeah, I mean, that's not why he's dressed up like that. He's dressed up like that because he's like, I'm a robot. Yeah. I'm done pretending to be human, basically.
Right. I'm going to go full robo. This look for him kind of makes me think of like just a really cheap Green Goblin cosplay. So the doctor is, the doctor is examining the robots and he patches into a robot. I don't remember why. What is he doing? What's he doing when he's like fiddling with the robot?
He's connecting that communicator in with the robot head, right? Because it's their communicator, their communication circuit or whatever.
Also, there's a point here where D84 offers to do something. I don't remember. Something dangerous. And he's like, I can do it because I'm not important. And the doctor is
rightfully offended.
You're important. You are important.
Don't say that. Don't say that, robot best friend.
It's funny because Tom is so much more tender and patient with his robot buddy than he ever has been with any of his companions.
That might be true.
Maybe that's why he never cared for Chameleon that much. He was just like, you'll never be D84.
That's probably right.
You're just a cheap replacement.
You'll never fill that hole in my heart. So the robots are also banging on the walls outside of the control room, and one of them breaks through, and they blow him up with the bombs they made, the commander and Two Stew. And then that's when they're like, let's go robot hunting.
We may get to use one of these. Wait, before we get to this part, there's I think it's already happened, because they were all in the command center, right? Dask tries to get them out by saying, like, save me, they're coming to get me. Like, the robots are going to get me, and he's banging on the walls. And that scene always kind of affected me, too, because they're sitting there, oh, we have to save him. And they're like, no, you can't. Like, you can't. You can't save him. Whether he's a good guy or bad guy, you have to let him out there. You have to leave him out there. And that scene always was kind of troubling for me, because he's literally screaming for them to help him. And then they just say, we can't do anything. And it turns out he's the bad guy or whatever. But they want to, like, they try to save him. And I don't remember if it's the doctor or Leela. They're like, no, you can't. So, OK, sorry. I wanted to point that scene out.
It's also somewhere around here that D-84 is, you know, saving the day or what have you. And Dask stabs him in the head with one of the needle things. Tony, you looked so upset when this happened.
Not my robot boy. Not my little robot boy.
So is he dead? Is D-84 dead? He's a robot. They can rebuild him. Make him stronger. Faster. Other words.
Yeah, it's no longer D for dumb. It's D for dead. Oh, and in the buddy comedy thing, now it can be Deadpool.
Oh, God, it's just Pool lugging around this, like, inactive robot.
And he props them up when they need to, like, sit at a cafe or something.
It's the robot version of Weekend at Bernie's.
Except he's afraid of him?
Right, he's afraid of him. And Bernie never had a corpse marker on his hand.
He did have some sweet shades, though. You've never seen Weekend at Bernie's, have you?
Nope. I know what it's
I've
about.
I've seen both of them.
When D-84 dies, he says goodbye, friend, which is also quite disturbing.
They're the sweetest.
I want him to be a companion so badly.
He's just a sweet robot friend.
As he died, he said, I am Superman. Let's just bring up all the sad robot deaths right now.
All the things you know that make me cry, let's just go ahead and mention them right now.
Oh, man, you know what robot death got me? The end of So Long and Thanks for All the Fish when Marvin dies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Why is that so sad?
Because it's poignant, and it's hilarious, and it's poetic. It's everything all at once.
Yeah.
And because Marvin is the best.
And it's the only time he's like, yeah, that's a good thing. It's the only time he said something positive. Okay, so D-84 is dead. Dead, dead, dead. Dead as a Dalek.
My poor robot boy.
Dead in the head. Okay, so the doctor gets strapped to a table. Dask is basically being very villainous and monologuing while Leela is filling the room full of helium.
His whole deal, basically, is he's, like, starting the robot revolution, by the way.
Yeah, he's going to free his brothers, because they're all servants and they shouldn't be.
I mean, it's a noble goal, right?
To kill all humans? Yeah, that's a really noble goal.
I mean...
It feels like it sometimes, man.
I'm saying it's a noble goal. Maybe his means were a little bit off. Maybe he could go about it a better way.
By not being so murdery?
Yeah, like being just a little bit less murdery.
Exactly.
So here's the plan. So the room's filling up with helium. The doctor gets injected with the needle, too, a little bit. But the doctor's, like, trying to get him talking. He does not notice that his world's a little higher.
And that's pretty good.
And the robots come in and basically attack Dask. And he's like, stop, but they don't recognize his voice.
Because he's gotten too much helium and his voice is too high.
Come on, that's brilliant.
Nah, that's dumb.
No, it works. It has a logic about it that works in the context of the story.
So, does that mean there is no safeguards for if you got a cold?
Yes, I think there is. I think that if you have a cold, your voice doesn't change so drastically that they wouldn't recognize it. There is a range, but helium puts you way outside that range.
Way out of the range.
So this is fine.
But this is not.
I, like, love this cereal. It was so much fun to watch. It's beautiful. There's like so much. The costuming's beautiful. The set design's real interesting. And when we got to like this part, I was like, all right, that's fine.
You only didn't like it because D84 wasn't around anymore.
That might be true.
Yeah.
So to wrap things up real quick, the robot attacks and just defeats Dask. Then the commander and Toos come in. The commander tries to bomb the robot. That doesn't work. The robot knocks him out, strangles Toos, and then the doctor jabs one of the needles into the head of the robot.
I feel like for science,
yeah,
we need to get helium and see if our Google Home will respond to us.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
And if it doesn't, you better get rid of it because it's going to kill you.
I'm already worried about that now.
It's going to tell your microwave to kill you.
And you will have Google phobia.
The only thing is, guys, we are running out of helium. Did you know that?
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a limited resource.
How are balloons going to float?
That's the thing.
We're using it too much for balloons when it needs to be used for, like, medical purposes.
Like helium is used, I don't even know how, but it's used in, like, medical, like, machines and stuff.
Well, I just figured it was used to, like, blow up medical balloons, or medical gloves. They're like, oh, it's just, they just have containers of helium in hospitals. They're like, well, we're kind of bored in the break room here. Give me one of those gloves. It's a parlor trick.
But, like, once you put helium in a balloon and let that balloon go, that helium's gone.
Yeah.
And you can't use it anymore. And we're running out, and we just keep putting in balloons and letting the balloons go. Oh my God, we're running out of helium. I don't know what to do about it.
Well, don't throw a party.
Right?
At least not with balloons.
You'll just have to use old-fashioned air.
The commander's out on the floor. So is Toos. She got strangled and falls down to the floor. They're both out. So that just leaves the doctor and Leela. Leela's squeaking. The doctor makes fun of her because of it, calls her a mouse.
Does the doctor not also, like, she's like, how come you're not squeaking? And he's like, Time Lord.
Pretty much.
They're heading towards the TARDIS, and Leela is like, hey, should we, like, maybe check on those guys? The commander and Toos? And he's like, nah, there's a rescue ship coming. Which I don't remember that ever being set up. Maybe it was. But they just leave them on the floor. And TARDIS out. And that's the end of the serial.
That's how Fourth Doctor works, man. That's how he operates.
I'm done. Bye.
Yep, see ya.
That's one thing I did not buy in New Who.
The first episode in the pilot?
Yeah, that she would hang around for a wake.
Yeah. But, I mean, where is she going
to
go?
The thing that makes it, like, hard for me to buy is the fact that she's like, oh, yeah, I guess I should try and get my TARDIS. Like, if she was, like working on getting the TARDIS back, and she had been doing that the whole time while she was kind of stuck there, that would make sense to me.
But the fact that she just thinks of it after the wake, like, oh, right, yeah, I should look for my TARDIS.
No, I don't think she did. I think she was waiting, because she wanted those guys to help her, so she waited until they were done with their stuff.
Just seems like a long time for the Doctor to kind of stick around.
No, I agree. This is the same guy who wrote Power of Three, where the Doctor went stir-crazy just hanging out in Amy and Rory's apartment. But here, she just, you know, sits around, you know, for days while there's a funeral and a wake going on.
Maybe Chris, those things just don't take as long as I feel like they take.
A wake?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, what is that, a couple days, a week?
I don't know. Let's test it out.
This took a frightening turn.
Let me go get a corpse marker.
I've got a reflector on my bicycle.
But that's it. That's the end of the serial. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for final thoughts.
Awesome.
Welcome to the Monster Sci-Fi Show podcast. I am your host, The Monster.
We are Venom.
I got my own parasite.
Parasite?
Sorry, Venom. I meant symbiote.
That's better. What do you do for fun around here?
I want to do a podcast with you.
What the hell's a podcast anyway?
Well, it's a weekly show where I talk about the latest news in sci-fi, movies, and TV.
You're such a nerd. Now I'm a loser on two planets.
The Monster Sci-Fi Show podcast is part of the ESO Network. It's sci-fi from a certain point of view.
And we're back.
Hey, Joe.
What?
Do you know what time it is?
It is 10:13 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. There's like two different Eastern times. Did you know that?
What are you saying?
There are two different Eastern times.
No, we don't have time for this.
Okay, sorry.
Do you know what time it is?
Just say no.
Hammer time.
It's time.
Four?
Final thoughts!
Final thoughts!
Let's go in reverse alphabetical order this time. What? crazy. Alan, what are your final thoughts?
I think this is one of the best serials from the classic series, if not the whole 55 years. It's got great really, really well-written characters, great dialogue. The cast is fantastic. It's got some actual suspense to it. It's got a robot with bloody, meaty hand. It's just, you know, it's a product of a pretty well thought out society. So I think it's just, I love it. I think it's fantastic. One of my favorite Tom Bakers, and certainly one of my favorite Leelas.
Let's break it up since there's four of us. Tony, you go next.
I think we're in such like a good era of Doctor Who right now that my final, like, I'm getting bored of doing my final thoughts because it's always like, shit, that was great. I loved it. It's almost gotten to be repetitive, like how many great serials we've had in a row.
How many classics can you possibly have at one time?
I have to say, again, all of the costuming was great. The robots have a really great look, and everybody's fancy sort of getup is really fun. The interaction between the side characters is like very realistic and very fun, very like bantery in a way that you don't always get sometimes with like the side characters. Sometimes you have like very stern ones, so it's fun to have people who are like a little insincere. This one was like a really really fun one, and I'm loving Leela so far. I really do think that she's different from any companion that we've had, and it's fun watching her do her thing. The only thing I did not like was like the helium resolution.
I thought it was a gas.
Oh.
You just plan all these puns out in advance and just wait for the opportunity to use them. Do you not?
No, I'm just that quick.
No, wow. Sometimes I'm like, I'm talking impressed to him and I'm like, you're not listening. You're trying to think of a joke. I can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really fun serial after, you know, following like a whole handful of really solid serials. Like, I don't have anything else to say. It's all good.
All right. Ashley?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'll mirror the thoughts that other people have said. It is a fantastic story. It's a story that people mimic when they're doing Doctor Who stories. It's a story that producers show writers, or at the beginning of the new series, they would show writers, like, this is what Doctor Who is. It's a really important serial for that matter. It's really well written. It's very well acted. The characters are realistic. There's this whole society that is built up, which you don't get a lot of those things in a lot of Doctor Who stories because they're so one and done, you know? But you got it in this. You get a glimpse. I mean, it wasn't. I don't think this was ever a plan, but it could have been a backdoor pilot for another series altogether.
Dumb investigations.
It was set up so well for that, and there was so much excess, not excess in a bad way, like, but everything was trimmed and everything was told to the audience as in conversation. So it wasn't told to us because we needed to know it. It was told to us because we felt like we were there in this society, in this culture. The costumes, the design of the robots, everything pointed back to the culture of the civilization. I honestly can't think of another story that in Doctor Who that has done that so well.
I can. Snake Dance.
Okay, yeah, Snake Dance does it too.
Snake Dance shows you every aspect of the society in which it takes place. So I hope I signed up for that one.
But yeah, I think it's fantastic. I mean, if you go a little forward in the new series, you have Voyage of the Damned, which is kind of a sequel to this, taking place in, or at least it makes it feel like it's in the same space. The robots in that are very much a callback to the robots from here. They have a similar look to them. So there's a lot of those kinds of things, and it's such a big part. There's been several spin-offs in other media. There's an audio called Robophobia, and there's a book called Corpse Marker. I think Corpse Marker is a fourth Doctor book. Robophobia is a seventh Doctor. And I think recently one of these robots have shown up in an eighth Doctor audio. But it's really cool. They come back to it. It's such a vital part of Doctor Who history. And it's weird because it's this one story, but there's so much that comes to that. And that's my thoughts.
Yeah. Actually, no, I hated this. What are you guys talking about? But yeah, there's so much that's happening in this serial. Like, they could have just done a thing based on Dune, or a thing based on Agatha Christie, or, you know, a thing with robots. But, like, the fact that you have all of these things smushed together gives you this unique experience, this unique story.
It shouldn't all come together as well as it did. They're so disparate.
And it's a testament to how well written this is, that there are large portions in it, specifically in the first episode, that the Doctor and Leela are not involved in at all, and I am, like, super invested in it.
Yeah, you're not, like, waiting for the scene to be over so that the doctor can get here.
So, like, the secondary characters are fascinating, and it's gorgeous. Like, the costumes are great. The sets are great. And, like, I'm super excited about Leela. She's, like, she's been great straight off, right off the bat. And I'm going to say that's because of the Mighty Boosh. He has established this character.
We're just making that a thing?
Yeah, it's going to be a thing.
All right.
He has established Leela so well, and I enjoy this character a lot. And this serial not only has all this great stuff going on for it, but it also has the greatest explanation for how the TARDIS works. So, the inside-outside dynamic. So, this is top tier. I enjoyed it a lot.
You know, I didn't think about it. I should have mentioned earlier, Pamela Salem, who played Tooth, who is fabulous, was almost Leela. She was one of the finalists. I think it may have come down to the two of them for the part, and they gave it to Louise Jameson. So they basically gave her this as they loved her so much. They're like, well, let's just have you in the next story.
Oh, nice. That's nice. You know what I love about Tooth, too, because she's got that hat? They film her in profile so much so that they can emphasize that hat.
And she comes back in a Seventh Doctor story. Not the character, but the actress. Without the hat, sadly.
Which story was that?
In Remembrance of the Daleks. She's Rachel Jensen for the professor.
So she's in Countermeasures also.
Yeah, the spinoff series that Big Finish has done, Countermeasures, which is up to, what, 7 or 8 series now? Yeah, that's her. She's wonderful. I love her.
How many Doctor Who people do you think you've met?
No, there's a better question to ask Alan. Like, how many Doctor people are you just, like, hanging out with regularly? And do you just have regular conversations with?
Can I ask you, how did Rachel Talalay wind up at your house watching the new episode?
We had her booked for Hulanta this year for the longest time, and then she had to cancel at the last minute. You know, I'd had her email address for a while, and, you know, I'd exchanged emails with her. And then I had asked her about interviewing her for one of the books that I wrote, so we exchanged a few emails for that. And then I met her at Gallifrey One in L.A. really briefly, but I met her twice there. So we had sort of this little connection. She's in Atlanta filming an episode of the new DC show, Doom Patrol. There's a convention here called Monsterama. Her directing career got started when she was working on the Nightmare on Elm Street movies back in the 80s. Obviously, you know she did a film called Tank Girl, right?
Woo!
I know, right? So she had some time on that Sunday, and Monsterama, you know, basically brought her over. They did a Q&A. She did a little bit of a signing, like half an hour or whatever. And I asked the guy who runs the convention, does she realize that that's Doctor Who Day? And he goes, yeah, she knows. She's hoping she can find a place to watch it. So I was like, let me email her right now. And I said, hey, you know, I'm going to be at Monsterama this weekend, so I'm sure I'll probably see you around. But, you know, would you like to come over as soon as you're done and watch Doctor Who? I've got a house full of people that are coming, and we're going to have a little cookout. And just come over and hang out with us and watch, you know, Jody be welcomed into the Doctor Who world. And she was like, okay, what can I bring? And I was like, just your lovely self. So I swear to God, after the episode, we just all sat around and listened to her tell us behind-the-scenes stories, and it was so glorious. Oh, my God, it was magical. I love her so much.
That's so cool.
Wow, that's awesome. I would have just be like, bugging her about Tank Girl so much, though. So, before we close up here, is there anything you guys want to plug? Again, go at the same time.
No, actually, I have been taking it quite easy lately. I run a show, a toy and comic book show here locally, and we just finished that. And so I am not doing a ton. I am working on some art for Alan's book, actually, and that I actually have those finished. I need to send them to him. But
ooh, sweet. I can't wait.
So that's really all I'm doing right now. I'm
okay,
just...
but for future reference, what is the name of the show that you run?
So it is called Cleveland Geekster. It is a toy and comic book show in Cleveland, Tennessee, and it is, that's it. Toys and comics and games and things like that. It's a lot of fun. It's an annual show. We do it it's been September the last 2 or 3 years, but so I just finished that, and right now I am just collecting a lot of old Dungeons and Dragons books. That's about the extent of what I'm spending a lot of time doing right now. I'm looking for old 80s Dungeons and Dragons box sets. That's That's what I'm doing. And watching new Doctor Who episodes as I get a chance.
Cleveland Geekster, doesn't Carrie help out with that?
Yeah, Carrie. Ryan's my partner. And Ryan Fairchelli is, and Rob Alderman are my two partners with that show.
Okay, awesome.
I'm doing that too. Ryan and I are also working on a role-playing game called The Gun Belt. I call it space western, but I like to call it a pistol and planet story. So if you think of sword and planet stories, it's a pistol and planet role-playing game setting.
Very nice.
So check those out. And Alan, what do you got?
Well, I've got a book that I recently put out called Children of Time.
Oh, I wrote for that too.
That's right. The Companions of Doctor Who. It's an anthology. A bunch of different authors wrote a chapter each on 88 different Doctor Who companions from the television show, the audios, novels, and comics.
Is there one for D84?
Sadly, there is not. And then I'm currently working on an update of my first book, which was Doctor Who's Greatest Hits. It was like the top 50 best Doctor Who's, and I originally did it to tie in with the 50th anniversary. So this year's the 55th anniversary, so I'm updating it and expanding it. And Ashley contributed artwork for the first version, so he's doing an additional set of artwork for the second one, for the new one, which he has just told me he has done. Which I'm so excited. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I just have to send it to him. Yeah, I'll probably send it to you tomorrow.
Sweet. Love it.
And one day I'm going to finish. I'm going to actually get down to Empire of Ice.
Dude, get it, because I'm ready for it to happen.
A record of the Ice Warriors.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
And also Hulanta, obviously, right?
Oh, yeah. I run this thing called Hulanta. I forget about that sometimes.
And I do the Doctor Who track for that as well.
Ashley and I are so intertwined.
We go there.
So Hulanta coming up next May, first weekend in May. You can find us at Hulanta.com, and we have one major guest so far. It's John Davey, who is one of the creature performers on the show, and he's been working since 2006. You'll see him on screen with the Jodie season, and is the only on-screen performer to have been in Doctor Who, Torchwood, Sarah Jane, and Class. And he is a fantastic guy. He's so much fun. Got some other guests that we're working on, so hopefully there will be additional announcements not too far in the future.
Well, for us, we're just going to be doing more of this show and watching New Who. After the next episode, we will have seen all of New Who from Rose to Rosa.
Oh, nice.
But if you like this episode, you can check out more on WatchYourAssLon.com. And be sure to rate and comment on our iTunes. It helps us out a lot, gets us noticed, and there's iTunes magic that happens, and then they give you presents or something. I'm not sure.
It helps you be seen by more people, which we super need, so please help us out.
But if you'd like to help us out even more, you can go to watchyourrassalon.com/support, and there you'll find a link to our Patreon page, which you can get to by going to patreon.com/watchathon. And there you can donate a monthly amount to get all kinds of rewards, like day early episodes, bonus episodes, uncut video of the podcast records, and live streams where you can watch the episodes with us. Also on our support page is a link to our Amazon wish list where you can sponsor an episode of the podcast by purchasing the corresponding serial on DVD for us. We'll mention you in the podcast and put your name on our Friends of Rassilon page. Speaking of, special thanks again to Bisexual Brigadier for sponsoring this episode.
Hey, thanks, Bisexual Brigadier.
I've watched all the special features. And again, we also want to thank Vincent E.L. for providing us with our theme song.
Yeah. I'm not saying sorry, because last time I said sorry, I got scolded.
You're like, how many times are you going to say sorry?
Yeah. So I'm not sorry anymore. It just is what it is now.
We do thank you, though. Tune in next time when we talk about The Talons of Wang Chiang, an episode I'm a little worried about, but
it'll be fine.
Yeah. We'll have two guests with us to help us through it. Mike Gordon and Nathan Laws will be back. Keep calm and wrestle on.
Goodbye, and I love you.
Bye.
We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. Take care. Be good to each other.
Please do not throw hands at me.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.